Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to the latest Quarantine Stream edition of the Cinema Clash. I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined from a distance of about 3 miles by Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Hey there, Charlie, what's cooking?
Did you invent the word Quarantine Stream? That's hysterical.
No, I didn't. I actually saw it today and I went, wow, it's joined the vernacular right now. And so I think I really like that.
That's good. I appreciate that. Thank you for bringing that in. We are Quarantine Streaming.
Exactly. And what does that mean for us?
Well, for me, it means, yeah, I'm still watching, you know, the Lynx and the Netflix and the Amazon. But you know what has really increased lately is Turner Classic Movies. I've hit that again. I'll go in waves. It's like a sine wave. Well, you know, 1 month I'll hit, you know, four of them, and then I'll go for 3 months and not do it. And this past week I've done like two. It feels great.
Did you watch some movie from like the 1920s? Did I see that somewhere?
I watched two from the 1920s. One was the most famous Buster Keaton, The General, and one was the first Best Picture Oscar winner ever, Wings.
Oh, and how did they compare to the first film that we're going to talk about this evening?
They don't compare at all, at all. And not because, you know, they're just completely different genres. Just, you know, that's the worst transition ever, Hannah. Our first film tonight, it was going to be a wide release. You could see this is going to be in theaters. It's called The High Note. No, The High Note has nothing to do with Buster Keaton, nor does it have anything to do with World War One. Biplanes.
That explains why I think I like The High Note a lot more than you did.
Now, yeah, if The High Note had World War One biplanes in it, okay, I would be a big fan. But The High Note has, I did not know. I know, you know, Dakota Johnson. I know she's the daughter of Melanie Griffith. I knew that from the 50 Shades franchise.
And Don Johnson.
And I knew Tracy Ellis Ross from Black-ish, but I did not know until watching the film who Tracy Ellis Ross's mother was.
Mm-hmm.
You want to fill us in?
I did.
How did you know that? I didn't know that.
Because I think she gave her mom an award recently at something. So I remember seeing her mother, Diana Ross, on stage with her, with Tracy Ellis Ross. And also, I believe I've seen Tracy Ellis Ross maybe doing some commentary on CBS Sunday Morning, but I'm still surprised to see her cast in this movie. The casting choice, I don't know, seemed a little odd to me, but she can sing, and this is her singing debut in a film, so I think she pulls it off just fine. But I think for the most part, this is actually more Dakota Johnson's film, playing the personal assistant to the singer that Tracy Ellis Ross is playing in this film.
Even though they have equal billing on the movie poster, you're right, this is a personal assistant film. And we all know the personal assistant film. Dakota Johnson's mother, you know, laid the groundwork for all contemporary personal assistant films with Working Girl.
Love that movie.
You can also think Devil Wears Prada, 2 Weeks mm-hmm. Notice. They're all about these put upon assistants who just can't see the end of the tunnel. You know, they're not necessarily abused. Well, Melanie Griffith was abused in certain ways, but they're not abused. They're just, you know, they're shunted aside. They're overlooked. They're taken advantage of. And so is Dakota Johnson's Maggie, who works for Grace Davis, played by Ross. Grace Davis, she's not playing her mother. She's made a point to say, I'm not playing my mother, Diana Ross. And the age doesn't match. She isn't. But I liked it too. If Whitney Houston was still alive, this would be Whitney mm-hmm. Houston. The age matches there. And so for 3 years, she's been Grace Davis's personal assistant. Drinks, dry cleaning, driver, just a horrible job. And what annoys me about The High Note is this is one of those themes where professional development is considered a crime. The worst thing you can do to your boss is grow a little as a person or as a professional. They say, what do you mean you now want to be a music producer or you want to do something with your life? How dare you? This is a personal affront to me. And when films like this venture into that territory, it's so annoying and unbelievable. Like Devil Wears Prada worked because Meryl Streep didn't do that. She actually expected her personal assistants to grow and become people in the fashion industry, where this one, Grace Davis, does not expect her personal assistants to grow. She doesn't even consider them human at times, and her manager, Ice Cube, definitely does not consider Maggie, you know, a complete human being.
Yeah, no, the manager, played by Ice Cube, really just wants the assistants to stay in the background, handle the logistics, grab the coffee, all that sort of thing. And he also wants Grace Davis, who's this famous singer with a slew of Grammys. She's got a greatest hits album. She's got a best-selling live album. And so the manager, Jack, says, you know, he wants her to just play it safe, keep the cash flowing, and do a greatest hits live album and do one of those Celine Dion-type Vegas residencies. But, you know, this is where the character development doesn't quite track throughout this film. You know, we find out that Grace really secretly wants to write and record and tour with new material. And then you've got Maggie, her assistant, who really wants to produce that material and is just hoping for that break. And the manager, you know, is really just trying to undermine her efforts. And so, you know, that part of it was very much to me a reminder of Devil Wears Prada. I still felt like I was watching kind of like a somewhat weaker version, but still entertaining of that kind of story. But then what this movie also introduces is some romance, and the romance is for Maggie. And that's with our boy Kelvin Harrison Jr. from Waves and Loose, playing a local talented young singer named David Cliff. And so how do he and Maggie end up doing a little old meet cute in there, Charlie?
Yeah, the Cinema Clash really helped launch Kelvin Harrison Jr.'s career. I mean, look at him now. He did our interview, and now he's just singing right alongside Tracy Ellis Ross. There's a coincidence in this film. I don't want to get into it. That's just so hard to swallow. And even it's so unbelievable. Even I didn't see it coming, and I see everything coming.
But yeah, I totally saw it coming. But
you knew that. Okay, I don't want to. But yeah, they have a grocery store meet cute, and he's got self esteem problems, and she's got self esteem problems. So put them together, and maybe they can give each other confidence. This the high note as it comes. There's a tone that it emits coming off screen that has a certain irony in it. You know, the sub theme of the film is Vegas residency. You know, it's like retirement, play it safe, earn some money, wake up late, minimal effort versus new material. Be true to yourself. Put yourself out there. You never know what could happen. Try. And the high note is actually a Vegas residency sort of rom-com. It feels lifeless. It has no smash. It's got no edge. And could somebody, dear God, save Bill Pullman?
Oh, that was to me the hardest part to swallow, is that Bill Pullman was so wasted in this film. And I love Bill Pullman. And so I was expecting way more from him because, you know, he's got enough star power that you see his name listed. And so he's in it for a minute as Maggie's dad. And so I was definitely disappointed with his minimal role in this film. But overall, you know, it's got the drama and the music and the romance, everything that you just sort of need for a mainstream friendly chick flick. And I think most people will still find it very enjoyable. It doesn't have the edge of Devil Wears Prada, or it did remind me a little bit of Whitney Houston in The Bodyguard when the diva is sort of shown on stage. And it would have been a film that would have been very interesting if it had had somebody with a bigger voice like a Whitney Houston. But overall, in this time of quarantine streaming, I think it's going to hit the right notes for a lot of people who are just looking for just an entertaining, enjoyable, easy to watch film.
It's too easy to watch. It actually hits kind of a sour note for me.
So you won't be buying the soundtrack, which also I believe is now out with the original song Love Yourself. So if you hear that at some point, that's where it's from. And we should note that it's, you know, it was scheduled to hit theaters earlier this month, and of course it could not. So now it's available on a slew of on-demand Prime Video, Apple TV, Xfinity, Vudu, Google Play, Fandango Now. So you know that that the studios are hoping, with all the marketing that they've done for this one, that it will make a dent where so many other films of late have not.
It probably will make a dent, but unlike, you know, everyone who has a Netflix subscription or an Amazon subscription, or even those weird people who have Hulu subscriptions, you actually have to go out there and you have to pay $20 to see this. It's yeah. not on a subscription service. You actually have to go find whatever platform you want to use and fork over $20 to sit there and watch this.
Don't watch it alone. Watch it with whoever you're quarantined with, and just sort of put yourself in the mindset of having gone to see a movie in the theater.
What you can watch if you have a Netflix subscription is The Lovebirds. Last week we talked about The Wrong Missy, which was popular for, you know, 4 days, but and now The Lovebirds, which is also going to be popular for 4 days until the next Netflix thing comes along. This was also supposed to have an April wide release, and I could see, you know, this is the kind of movie that would, you know, probably win its weekend. But instead of going the pay $20 per platform route like The High Note, it just switched over to a Netflix distribution. We know the people behind and in front of The Lovebirds because of The Big Sick. You remember The Big Sick from 2017? Mm-hmm. Kumail Nanjiani, he's back. He's part of the couple out of water in this film. He's the male half. And the director, Michael Showalter, he directed The Big Sick. We also know him from Hello, My Name is Doris. Remember Sally Field in that?
Yeah.
And he wrote just one of the funniest comedies from the early 2000s, Wet Hot American Summer. I love that movie. Kumail is starring opposite Issa Rae. She is just delightful in this film. I actually have never really seen her before. I've never seen her show Insecure. And so
she was in The Photograph. You were supposed to go see The Photograph.
I didn't see The Photograph either. But
another romantic drama.
Yeah. The story of The Lovebirds is very, very familiar. You know, it's a couple out of water. They're out of their comfort zone. We saw this in Date Night. This is very similar to Steve Carell and Tina Fey in Date Night. And even more recently, Jason Bateman, I think, and Rachel McAdams in Game Night are very close cousins. And there's also actually a bit of Eyes Wide Shut mask scenarios in there. It's funny. I didn't guffaw during The Lovebirds, but I laughed at some of the situations they get themselves in, at some of their arguments, their bickering. You know, they have such a great first like 5 minutes of how they fall in love, and then, you know, 4 years later how all they do is fight. They can't even just have a regular conversation. They just pick at each other, and it's really funny, and it saves Kumail from that last terrible movie he was in called Stuber.
See, I liked Stuber better than this one.
Oh my God.
Yes. I mean, it was stupid, but I was so disappointed in this film. And there seems to be a huge divide. Some of my friends have hated it. A friend of mine gave it an F for his review. And despite my review, which I did not exactly sing its praises either, my brother and his wife enjoyed it. Of course, he also liked The Wrong Missy, so we're not necessarily on the same wavelength with these films. But I loved the first 10 minutes. I thought this film had such incredible promise. I thought Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani were both very likable. But then I thought that whole hour in the middle before the formulaic end to this romantic comedy drama thing, I just thought the middle made no sense at all. I totally zoned out. It could have been such a beginning to end charming film, but I think what they do is they hit you with a good first 10, 15 minutes. They sort of hit you with a decent final 10 minutes, and they expect you to forget the hot mess that falls in between where this couple is, you know, about to break up, and then all this stuff happens over the course of the night, and they end up, of course, reevaluating their relationship at the end and sort of reconnecting. And so to me, the disappointment was in just how it fell apart. And I wanted it to be better, and I liked the leads, but I liked, for instance, the High Note way, way more than the Lovebirds.
We agree strongly on the word formula. This is absolutely paint by numbers. There's nothing new here to the story, to the plot. They're in over their heads. They don't know what to do, and they just trip over their shoelaces the entire film, going from point A to B to C, trying to solve this mystery that doesn't even really matter what the mystery is. We're here for the one-liners, the punchlines, and that's what worked for me. I thought they were so funny, the awkward situational comedy, which is why I like the Lovebirds way better than the High Note.
But all those one-liners, you can just watch the 3-minute trailer and you see them all.
See,
the trailer,
you're proving
is
my
the
point about why you should not
film.
Watch trailers. I don't watch trailers, therefore that's why I laughed. All these jokes were new to me why I laughed so hard at them.
I watched the trailer after I watched the movie. That's how I know this. And so I was like, okay, in 3 minutes you can actually get all the funny stuff. So you can spare yourself like the additional 87 minutes.
And, you know, this movie did not need to be 88 minutes. 87 is perfect for this film. Seriously, there's nothing new here, but Date Night is better. Game Night is better. Mm-hmm. Eyes Wide Shut is better. It's better than The Wrong Missy. You know, if you want to make use of your Netflix subscription, you feel bad. Hey, I'm not doing my, you know, whatever it is. What is it? $10.99 a month now? $12.99 a month, one of those. You know, and you feel like, hey, I need to watch a movie. This one's new. It's number one in the queue. It's number one in America. I guarantee you it's better than The Wrong Missy. And you will laugh. You will. It's funny.
You will laugh and you will like both of these leads. But if you pay attention to what's happening in the middle, which is nothing, which is weird.
No, the scene with the horse, that was funny. I didn't care for them singing Katy Perry's Firework. That's a little, you know, old, but when they break into the frat boy's house and they fight, that's hysterical.
That's just it. There's a weird masked sex cult, and there's dirty cops, and there's, there's frat boys. And that's just it. To me, I just wanted something different in the middle. And so I actually think if I could only have had these two in Issa Rae and Nanjiani in The Wrong Missy, then it would have been, to me, that would be sort of that perfect combination.
I cannot see Issa Rae playing The Wrong Missy. No.
It'll be very interesting because there's definitely a split. People either really enjoyed the Lovebirds or they really did not. So we'll find out. I'm curious what our listeners choose to watch and what they have to say.
Well, I'm going to shock our audience here. I'm known as kind of a, you know, I never see 4-star films. I never see masterpieces. They don't meet my expectations. Hannah, I ran into one this week. I ran into a 4-star best movie of the year so far. This thing blew my mind. I am talking about The Vast of Night, which you can see today on Amazon Prime Video. Please, everybody listening, go watch this movie.
If you're a Charlie type of movie watcher.
No, it's not. It's not arty. It's not foreign. It's in English.
It is a 90-minute episode of The Twilight Zone. And so if you are a fan of that genre, absolutely, it's very cool to watch. But it's an episode of The Twilight Zone.
It's the best episode of The Twilight Zone ever made. We're in the late... I've never even seen an episode of The Twilight Zone. I can tell you it's the best episode of The Twilight Zone ever made.
Then you've never seen the one with William Shatner in the airplane. That's all I can say. You'll have to look that up.
So we're in the late 50s here. Think, it's pure. It's innocent. The entire small town of Cayuga, New Mexico is at the high school gym watching the high school basketball game. And we're watching just two characters. Everett, he's a future radio man. His mouth moves a mile a minute. You can almost catch every word he says, but he talks so fast and he's got a lot of slang and he thinks he's a little slick more than he is. And he's chatting with Faye Crocker. We love Faye Crocker. She is hometown girl, but you know, she's going to run a conglomerate someday. She's obsessed with these science magazines and popular mechanics. She's saying, you know, in the future, a voice is going to come through your radio while you are driving and give you directions. And she predicts, you know, then she talks about smartphones in your front pocket. I just love listening to these two chat. You know, Faye Crocker runs the switchboard and Everett runs this old analog radio station. And for you nostalgia people, especially our executive producer, Joe Bordeaux, would love watching just the radio station in this film. It is science fiction. So we're talking about their sounds coming through antenna. There's sounds coming through the switchboard. There's sounds coming through the radio station. Something's up in the sky. We don't know what it is. We can't see it. You can't really hear it, but it's up there. And Everett on the radio say, hey, call in, folks. Here's the sound. Listen to this. Call in if you've heard this sound. And people call in. And it's like, hey, I've heard this sound. Here's my experiences with it. And that's where director Andrew Patterson takes off and just has so many good, not gimmicks, so many good ideas that just maneuver this story in unexpected places. We are listening to an actually very long caller saying, this is what I know about the sound. And I didn't even notice it. I didn't even notice it that the screen went black for like 5 minutes, five full minutes. You see nothing on screen. You are just listening to a voice. And I was leaning forward, listening to the story, enraptured, engaged. This movie is phenomenal, Hannah.
Well, you and our buddy Travis Hobson of Punch Drunk Critics both really love this movie. He also felt that that this director is one to watch, Andrew Patterson, in the future. And it did. It won the Audience Award for Best Narrative Feature at Slam Dance. And for those who don't know, Slam Dance is the showcase for raw and innovative filmmaking for the Charlies of the world to gather while the Hannahs are watching the mainstream movies down the street at Sundance. So that's really what I think is important to note in this film. I watched it, but I was distracted. And so then I saw your 4-star review and, you know, kind of got the vibe of your obvious disdain for my lack of comprehension or focus for this film.
I knew you were distracted. I knew you were distracted.
Yes. But so I went back and I watched it a second time. I actually did go back and I watched it again and I took your advice and I kept my phone away. I kept the room dark and I gave myself over to, you know, for however long this film was, like around 90 minutes to sort of allow myself to be transported back to this sort of this very Twilight Zone-ish kind of thing. And I liked it more, but it's really important. I mean, nobody is going to grasp the film the way you do if they don't commit to watching it the same way you did. And it requires commitment and it requires some silence because you could very easily just sort of turn away for 30 seconds and then you discover that your screen is totally black. And the fact that it goes on for 5 minutes, you might think, oh my gosh, I lost the picture. And so you really have to stay with it. And so I just think that's important to sort of point out because I do think that, folks who like classic, you know, really old classic films and classic televisions and sci-fi. And it did remind me of some of those like old radio shows and mystery shows on the radio. So I definitely allowed myself to get into it and I enjoyed it way more the second time around. But again, it's more for you than for me. It's not the kind of film that I necessarily would kind of go out of my way to see, but I can see why you and some others would definitely put it up there and sort of keep the word out in the hopes that some people might go and try and find it on Amazon Prime.
The Vast of Night was rejected by Sundance. It was rejected by South by Southwest. It was rejected by Tribeca, Cannes, and even the Seattle International Film Festival, which they show over 300 films for a month, and this didn't make that cut. The one film festival it made, Slam Dance, it won. The curators of film festival whiffed. This movie will catch on. People are just going to be like, all right, let's try this. 90 minutes. What's going to hurt? Then, and buzz is going to build. People are going to talk about The Fast of Night. You're going to hear about this. I guarantee you this will, I'm not saying it's going to become a cult classic, but there will be word of mouth accelerant on this film.
It felt a bit of sort of Blair Witch Project meets Close Encounters of the Third Kind vibe to me, with some Area 51 type stuff thrown in. So if that kind of mystery cover up, where is this going to go? Kind of innovative filmmaking grabbed you, then sure, The Vast of Night would probably be your choice over something like The High Note or The Lovebirds or any of the lightweight stuff that's out there right now.
I mean, it's better than the early years good films like First Cow and Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. It just blows them out of the water. It's not even close.
Yeah, no, I never did see the Cow one, but I do think it would have been high on some critics' lists. But it again, got to commit. If you don't commit, and if you never liked an episode, if you watched and did not like The Twilight Zone, then you're not going to like The Vast of Night. If you like The Twilight Zone, then this is exactly, it really will bring you back into that era. It almost feels like you're watching an episode on a little 50s television set.
No, absolutely. Put the kids to bed, put your phone away, turn the lights off, watch this, just you and television screen glare. It's not a beer movie. It's not a wine movie. I'd almost say sip a whiskey. it's that kind of a film.
Or a milkshake from the drive-in, feeling like you're throwing back to the 50s and while everyone's out enjoying the game at the local high school. So it had some of that in there too. Interesting though, because I mean, I do think it's all proof that if you really want proof that expectations and thresholds vary in this time of quarantine viewing, I find it fascinating that Uncut Gems is at the top of Netflix right now, trending. And so is the Adam Sandler 2011 rom-com Just Go With It. So two Adam Sandler movies where he is two very different characters, both are in the top 10 right now of Netflix. And so it's just who knows who's watching what. And or if there are just so many Netflix people that just absolutely love Adam Sandler, no matter what kind of role he's playing.
Now the rest of the world can feel as nervous as I did while watching Uncut Gems. That is a rough watch.
It is. Uncut Gems is a rough watch. And so I'm actually rather surprised. But I think it's one of those things where when something is trending, it does get your attention. The same way like Tiger King was trending, so a lot of people who would not have watched Tiger King did watch it because they wanted to know what all the fuss was about. And so I think there's sort of going to be that same curiosity factor going with Uncut Gems, which, I mean, Adam Sandler was, his name was batted around there for a while for a potential Oscar nomination for that film. So it's, whereas I can't imagine that he would have been up for an Oscar with Just Go With It with Jennifer Aniston. But, it just shows the range of things that people may be interested in watching or catching up with right now.
Now, Uncut Gems was easily, by far, the most challenging time I had in a movie theater last year. It's probably in the top three most challenging movies I've ever seen in my entire life, is how hard it is to watch that movie.
Yeah, I have no desire.
Really it's a good movie. It's a thumbs up, but oh my Lord.
But once was enough. And so whereas I would not go out of my, I would not see Uncut Gems again. I would just have no reason to. Because it's trending, I am curious maybe to go back and watch the rom-com, Just Go With It. And the other one that I'm definitely going to try and catch up on that you mentioned was very good, and Artie Chick Flicks just reviewed and said it was very good, is The Half of It. So I'm hearing good things from a whole bunch of people with a lot of different movie tastes. And so I'm thinking that that's going to be one to catch.
Yeah, you need to hurry up and catch up on that.
I
know you were, no one wants to see another version of Cyrano de Bergerac, especially with teenagers, but this is a cut above. I really think you're going to be surprised and like, okay, you got me. I did overlook this one just because I prejudged. It's that good.
Oh, I didn't prejudge. I was just tapped out. And so that's why sometimes I will sort of take note of something and seek it out. And so the half of it's on my list to seek out, as are a few other things that that are being thrown our way. So what's on tap potentially for next week?
I threw you a documentary on because we're coming from two different places. This one's called You Don't Know Me, and it's about Nomi, aka Elizabeth Berkley, from Showgirls. It's the documentary of Showgirls and what that did. Well, I'm assuming it's about what it did to pop culture in like 1996 when it came out. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation because we were in two different places in our lives in 1996. And so yeah, I want to compare notes on our experiences with Showgirls. And
I'm not sure I ever saw Showgirls, so now I'm feeling I need to watch.
You can't have this conversation without having seen Showgirls.
So now I feel like I have to go back and also watch Showgirls in order to watch You Don't Know Me on demand. N-O-M-I. And but if I watch that, I keep pushing you to watch a documentary called Spelling the Dream that's on Netflix about the Indian Americans who tend to win the National Spelling Bee every year. And it's got a very interesting take. It's got similarities to previous documentaries, but I still think you might enjoy it. And so we can talk about that one next week too. There's Willem Dafoe in a movie called Tommaso that I had never heard of.
I want nothing to do with that movie.
There's some ensemble horror movie called The Dinner Party that they sent us. There's one called Into Her Own that seemed like that's more for Artie Chick than for me. Another one called Shirley with Elizabeth Moss. I really don't know what that one's about.
Shirley Jackson.
Who is?
The author of one of the most famous short stories ever, The Lottery.
Oh, okay. Well, so that was an option. But with all of those things happening, I think that I may also just give myself a little bit of a break and watch the SpaceX launch if it happens, and then binge watch a little bit of a Space Force on Netflix because I feel like I might need a little comedy in there for the weekend.
Shoot me a text when you start if you actually start watching Showgirls. I want your immediate gut reaction at the end of it.
Yeah, I remember what it was about, but not necessarily that I needed to see it.
It's a beloved cult classic. It's not, well, I don't want to get into it yet. But
you should have a vested interest in Space Force, shouldn't you?
Yeah, I am going to watch Space Force. I have two people that work for me who have already applied to the Space Force. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've heard mixed reviews on it. Like don't judge it by the first episode. Keep going. It gets better is the word on the street.
Okay, good to know. So maybe we'll have that on tap. Anything else for this week, Charlie?
Maybe more Turner Classic Movies. We'll see.
All right, sounds good. Maybe you'll get up to 1930s by the end of the year.
Yeah, those 1920s movies are dude. That's pre-code stuff, you know. Clara Bow almost had a little frontal nudity shot there. I was like, oh, Clara, dear me.
Oh my goodness. Well, there was no rating system back then, so who knows what they'd call it now.
They'd call it Showgirls. That's
something tells me not. But all right, well, I will try to watch Showgirls anyway. Thanks so much for listening to The Cinema Clash. On behalf of Charlie Jewell and me, Hannah Buchdahl, stay safe out there, continue wearing the mask and washing your hands and all that fun stuff.
And watch The Vast of Night.
Goodbye.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.